And also when we opened in 82 was the last time we had a really major El Nino where it rained all summer. Like, it was one of the worst we ever had. So everyone mortgaged their homes. They built this business, small business loan from the local credit union, and everybody had to put their house up. And then it rained. And all the seating was outside for the whole summer. One of two things is going to happen. You're either going to die or you're going to innovate.
Welcome back to Success Unscripted, the podcast where we peel back the curtain on real stories of success in the business world. I'm your host, Jonathan Israel, a financial advisor with Affinity Wealth Partners at UBS Financial Services. To make my compliance officers happy, I'll mention that UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC, and my office is located in Los Angeles, California. I can be reached at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com. Joining me today is Michael Ungaro, CEO of the iconic San Pedro Fish Market, which was founded by his grandfather in 1956. Under his family's ownership, the business has grown from a small fish stand to a world record-setting restaurant, seating over 3,000 patrons, feeding 20,000 people weekly, and serving up over 2 tons of shrimp each week. Michael is also star of the award-winning docudrama Kings of Fish, streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Michael, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I can't believe it's already Thanksgiving.
Can you believe that?
No.
The holidays just pop up on you. It seems like Halloween was just yesterday.
It does seem like that. What is the Thanksgiving tradition in your family?
So for my family, everyone comes to my house on Thanksgiving. Then we go to my brother Henry's on Christmas Eve. And what'll happen is it's more potluck. Nobody eats turkey, but I'll make a bunch of it anyways. And it'll take all day and stress me out and it'll probably piss me off. And then Henry will roll in with a giant prime rib that everyone will eat.
Okay. So we have dual roles here because everyone comes to my house for Thanksgiving. I make a turkey and I stress about it. Nobody cares about turkey.
Yeah.
Right. And my wife makes a brisket because she doesn't even eat the turkey. So she makes a brisket. Everyone loves the brisket. There's so much turkey left over. But I feel like you can't have Thanksgiving without turkey.
Yeah. I've been really debating because last year I remember vividly, I have an Electrolux oven that has a perfect turkey setting. I don't know if you've ever seen this.
No.
So every year I go, it's going to take hours to cook this turkey. But the Electrolux can do it in 2.5 hours. And I'm in denial of it every freaking year. It does a perfect turkey in 2.5 hours. You'd put the thermometer in. You know, I have a marinade I do too. And it comes out perfect every time. But I don't believe it. You know, like I'm in denial every single year. And it does, but it does work. And then I'm sitting there going, well, last year, I'm like, I'm going to believe. I'm going to believe this year.
Yeah.
I'm going to put it in later and it'll come out. Mm. And now I'm carving like crazy and the knife was broken. The marinade thing popped and I'm so irritated and sweating and hot that I'm sitting in my backyard. I have like another room that we built off the garage that can seat 25, 30 people and tables. So you can get 50 people for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I'm watching everybody because I'm so completely exhausted. All I could do is drink a beer and sit in a corner. And I'm looking at Anita comes over, my wife comes over. She goes, are you okay? I'm never making a turkey again. We figure something out.
I always feel like that after every year. And then every year I go, nah, I got to do it.
And you know, what's interesting too, is the recipe kind of comes from my mother-in-law who doesn't know how to cook anything. She got married not even knowing how to boil water, right?
Yeah, okay.
And her husband was a military guy who's totally happy with Spam. But she has this marinade that she saw on TV on like a cooking show in the 70s, you know, soy sauce and garlic and lemon and a bunch of herbs. And you marinate the turkey overnight and, you know, put it under the skin. It's really good. And I've kind of modified it over the year to like butter and basil and orange. It's actually tastes great. It's just, it takes time.
Yeah.
You know, and then I got the whole thing done and carved and it's all ready to go. Then I try to open one drawer and the spatula popped up and I can't get the drawer open. And my daughter's like, Dad, are you going to be okay? No, I'm not.
You guys are Italian, right?
Yeah. Loud too.
That's so funny. I'm so excited to have you on because we talk to a lot of successful people, but this business, your business, is an iconic family business spanning generations. Anyone who lives in LA who enjoys seafood knows the San Pedro Fish Market. So let's start. Tell me about the market.
Yeah. You want like a little history background?
Yeah, absolutely.
So started in 1956 by my grandfather, as you mentioned earlier. It was more of a front. He's doing other things. He needed to show some income. And he said, you know, I'm going to do this. I don't know somebody
else. I don't know what that means. Should I ask you more about the details of?
He was a bookie. You know?
He was a bookie?
He was a bookie, yeah.
Oh,
and,
wow.
I didn't know this till I was a lot older. Like, I learned all these stories later, right?
Yeah.
And so he kind of gave my dad and his best friend, and actually a lot of their friends, but he gave my dad and his best friend a chance. He goes, I'll pay for you to go to school or you can run this business I'm going to start, which is this little fish market. And it was 200 square feet, corner store selling fresh seafood to the locals out of like stainless steel ice chests. Very basic.
Yeah.
And so they did that. They said, we hate school, so we'll work this thing. And they would walk there after high school and with all their buddies, and they ran this place. And I think for the most part, a lot of them were just kind of goofing around based on stories I hear, like lighting fireworks and seeing if they could blow the ice chest up and then shattering all the glass in the liquor store next door, that kind of stuff.
No, oh, wow.
But Tommy, my uncle, he was like really serious about it. Like he was like aggro serious, like, we're going to make this work. You know, yeah. If you went to like career day, one of the guys that was part of this, who's the only one of the group to go to college and become an executive and retire in his 50s from a major pharmaceutical company, right? He gives me a different perspective on this from all the guys that just stayed in the labor part of working the business. If I go back to high school and they had career day and they went around the room and asked everybody what they wanted to do, Tommy said, I just want to own the biggest fish market in town. So he was focused on that, whereas my dad was just, okay, cool, do whatever, I'm along for the ride. But Tommy was super like hyper-focused on creating this big business. So it went from 200 square foot in 1956, I think in 59, they moved down to the waterfront and took over a place called Norm's Landing. Norm's Landing was not, there wasn't really anything on the waterfront at that point. It was more like a bait and tackle store, like the fishermen would use, but it was also a fish market. And they had like shrimp cocktails, and they just started innovating and testing and trying different things. Smoked fish was one. They started figuring out how to do smoked fish, and they would sell it to companies, local companies like Starkist was in the area at the time.
Oh, wow.
A lot of big seafood companies came out of San Pedro. A lot of the seafood was coming through the port. Okay. Sardines, mackerel, squid, but they weren't doing the—
This is all locally caught stuff,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
right here off the coast?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bottom up families in San Pedro made a very successful living selling seafood, but wholesale. So we were on the retail side, and they were experimenting and learning seafood and doing okay. And then fast forward to like 1982, I'm 11 years old, and we're reopening. Because what's happening is this waterfront's getting redeveloped. They're building what's called the Port Skull Village. And it had started to be built in the 60s, but in the late 70s, they wanted to expand, and we were in the way. So we had to leave Norm's Landing and work out of a parking lot for about a year. But we were able to secure property in between this development. So they sort of built around us because we had a lot of friends in politics and business who were very favorable to us and said, listen, you know, you need to build something down there. It's great, going to be a great attraction. Because this was one of the first waterfront attractions. Like Disneyland was really all you had. Maybe Knott's Berry Farm, I think. But this was the first time like this idea of a theme park was being built on the waterfront. So Port Skull was kind of like it had sort of a New England feel, but also had this sort of Polynesian feel too. So you had these like Polynesian style restaurants, but you also had this New England feel with cobblestone on the waterfront. So it was a themed event, a themed project. We were in the way of it. So we were able to use the relationships we had to get to secure essentially, I think it was probably 10 to 20,000 square feet at the time. And we built San Pedro Fish Market, which opened on Good Friday in 1982. I was 11 and we all went to work. Now trying to make this thing work.
Wow. You started at 11 with the company.
I actually started at 7, but I only worked 1 year.
What was your job when you were like that young?
You know, what happened was my mom had to have gallstone surgery, which at the time was like a big deal. Now it's like outpatient. You go on the same day. But at the time it was like, you know, the nurses are telling her, say goodbye to your children. You might not see them again. You know, it was like a serious thing.
Oh, yeah.
So myself and my brother, John, were the older ones. We had to go to work with my dad. Because he was working every day straight for 2 years to get this thing going. And my younger ones would go and stay with my grandparents. So we would go to work with him, and we had never had a restaurant before. So this was new to us, you know, so we had this dining room.
It was just selling fish.
It was fish with like smoked fish, corn on the cob. You could get live crab and lobster, and you could get shrimp cocktails. I don't really think there was much else that you could eat, you know.
Okay, yeah.
And they're all walking food. It wasn't a restaurant.
Okay.
So you walk up this, you know, window and order it and walk around the area.
I see.
So now we've got a dining room, and my job was to go in there and wipe the tables down and make sure like on the booths, all those little edges where the crumbs collect, clean all that out with a toothpick, wipe the whole thing down, set the tables with forks and knives and placemat and get it ready to open.
Your father was your boss?
Yeah.
How was that?
He was actually really cool. My dad was easy boss. Tommy was also a boss. He was a tyrant, though. Still a little bit of a tyrant.
He's still there.
Still a little bit.
I see him on the show, the Amazon show.
He's still around. The other thing we would do is, because one of my dad's primary roles for a long time was creating the smoked fish. Like we had a different location in the city of Wilmington that was a smokehouse. It was sort of a commissary. It was really storage and a smokehouse. So we had smokers and they'd smoke seafood there. And we had a few accounts still. We grew up with him a lot of times going to that area and learning how this fish was smoked. It's like a 2-day process to do a hot smoked fish, salmon, albacore, halibut, tuna. The other thing I was doing was setting up the smokefish display because we had a pretty substantial one at the time. So I would have to get them out and there's a certain way to do it and make sure it looks nice. And then the rest of the day was just scaling fish for customers, scaling and gutting. Because we would sell, the way the market worked when we reopened it was you had this dining room area and then you had a kitchen area where you can walk up and order off a counter.
Okay.
And you can get fish and chips, you can get burgers, hot dogs. We could also get swordfish sandwich, calamari and fries. And then all the seating was outside. There were like 300 seats on the waterfront.
Yeah.
So you can go up, order your stuff, go sit outside, or you can go sit in the dining room and have somebody take your order for you. What also happened was it didn't work. And also when we opened in 82 was the last time we had a really major El Nino where it rained all summer. Like it was one of the worst we ever had. So everyone mortgaged their homes. They built this business. You know,
I was going to ask you how they funded this whole operation.
Everyone SBA just loan, or it was a small business loan from the local credit union, and everybody had to put their house up.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I don't know what it cost. I mean, my brother Henry just recently found a whole bunch of the original invoices for what we paid. Like, I think the kitchen, I want to say it was like $200,000 or something. Actually, it couldn't have been that much. It was like a tenth of what it costs now. Anyways, the cost to do it was much, much lower in the 80s than it is now. As you can imagine.
Right. But yeah, I mean, but still, I mean, it sounds like everyone pretty much put everything on the line to make this happen.
Everybody did. And then it rained and all the seating was outside for the whole summer. So what that does is when you get in those situations,
people don't want to eat in the rain, huh?
No, turns out they don't.
Yeah. Okay.
So one of two things is going to happen. You're either going to die or you're going to innovate your way out of it. And so what my uncle was really good at was looking at what other people were doing. Because there's different types of innovation, right? You can create and invent something on your own, or you can look at a different innovation, somebody else's innovation, someone else's invention, and say, hey, how do we adapt that into our business? Like adopt it in, adapt to it, and then exploit it.
Yeah.
So he was going to other restaurants and he was seeing things like at the time, fajitas had just become popular. And there was a local restaurant called El Paso Cantina. And it was, you know, it was a few locations in Southern California. And he's like, look at this thing. They're doing like fajitas with chicken and steak. We could do that with seafood. I'll get a vegetable cutter and we'll get tomatoes, bell pepper, and onions, right? We have a crab tank we built with steamers. So I'll get red potatoes because those are popular with seafood on the East Coast. Like he's innovating.
Yeah.
Right? He's copying stuff and he's innovating.
Yeah.
And we'll put these potatoes in the steamer. And then we had a giant walk-in that you could drive a forklift through, right? So we'll just put all these potatoes in the cooler, let them chill. And then we'll cut them ourselves into quarters and we'll mix them in with the veggies. We'll make our own seasoning, like our version of like a Cajun Old Bay, which we did. And we'll let people buy their own fish. It just kept evolving. At first, it was like, we have all this fish we're smoking that's frozen. It's great quality stuff. You can't thaw it out and it doesn't look good, but it tastes fine.
Right.
So we'll cut that up. We'll mix it with the veggies. We'll mix it with the potatoes, the seasoning. We'll go to the local bakery and we'll get some garlic bread, give people a choice of garlic bread or tortillas. And over time, this evolved and it became basically what we became known for, which is these world famous shrimp trays.
The shrimp tray evolved from that.
Yeah, that became a shrimp tray. The other thing he did I think he was in a junkyard and he saw these rendering tanks they would use to like when a cow was, whatever was left on the cow, they'd burn it up into these tanks.
Yeah.
And like all the fat would render off and whatever they did with it.
Yeah.
We found him in a junkyard and he goes, it's just a barbecue. He took it for free, put some charcoal in it, ran a gas line. And then for an extra dollar, if you wanted to buy a whole fish, we would barbecue it for you outside. And the scent went up in the air and people could smell it. And it was an experience.
Oh, wow.
And we'd also do, you were talking about, I think you mentioned lobster at some point before we started, right? And so local lobster is big at the time, the spiny lobsters. When those came in and they were more affordable than they are now, they were expensive, but they were nowhere near the price they are now. We would do a Friday night lobster barbecue. And then we'd add karaoke to it. So
do you still do that?
No, we've been thinking about bringing it back though. You'd have these barbecues outside and you'd have whole lobster cut in half on the barbecue and you had like a salad bar and pasta and whatever else. And then there would be like a karaoke thing going on. So we just were trying to get people to come down. The other thing we did was people would ask, well, I don't know if I want shrimp, but can I buy some other seafood and have a tray made out of it? It's like, yeah, for an extra dollar a pound, you can do that with anything here. So people started to get creative and invent their own combination of seafood.
Oh, nice. And what other seafood do you have?
Well, at that time, I mean, things have changed a little in the last couple of years, but we had, I think our showcase was like 50 or 60 feet long maybe. So we had a huge variety of seafood. We had, you know, salmon, swordfish, snapper, sole, sea bass. 6-7 different types of shrimp, maybe 8, octopus, calamari, all kinds of different shellfish, and then a ton of whole fish. We'd have maybe three or four different varieties would come out of Mexico, like a Mexican red snapper. It's called the Huanchinango or Cabrilla, which is a sea bass, pargos. We'd have halibut, shark. We had tons. And it would just depend on what was fresh in the season, what we can get. One of my favorites would be like white sea bass when it was fresh. They come in fresh. They don't freeze well. But when you have the fresh white sea bass on the barbecue, like marinated in teriyaki or garlic and onion, it's just incredible. And the bellies too.
My son loves seafood. My wife's Filipino, but she doesn't eat fish.
Really?
Yeah. And I never grew up eating a lot of fish either. And so my son actually got us all, not all, but he got me eating fish. We went to the market and we went to Whole Foods and he would go over to the fish section, you know, where they have the fish on ice and all that.
Yeah.
And he would want it. He goes, I want to eat that. And I was like, what little kid looks at like this, like dead fish and say, I want to eat that.
Yeah.
But that was him. He wanted to eat that. And so it was so funny.
What was it? Something random or
snapper or something. It was like, yeah, but then he would, and then it just evolved from there. And he's like, well, I wanted to try clams. I'm like, dude, I don't know how to make clams. Like, but he's like, just, I want to try clams. I want to try octopus.
Just text me.
Next time I will. I'll text you. And so the other day is so funny because my wife was putting together a little shopping list and he takes the shopping list on the counter and he writes on it 6 lobster tails. And I said,
6?
Yeah. I said, who is this for? He goes, it's for me. And I was like, well, are you going to share it with me? He's like, no, I want all 6 of them.
Wow.
But you know, you go to Whole Foods and they sell like those 2 lobster tails in a package and like $20 for 2 of them. Too. And so last time I bought that and made it for him and he ate it and he was like, more. And I was like,
how old is he?
He's 7.
Wow.
Yeah. But
incredible.
He got us all into fish. And so now I enjoy eating fish now.
So all the stuff that we do, you can order online and we ship it around the country and it cooks in like 10 minutes.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, it's on our website. But you can go to like goldbelly.com. And
yeah, Goldbelly is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, search. Like that's where I send most of my Christmas gifts for different people from bakeries and stuff. But you can go on there and San Pedro Fish Market has its own page. And we have a bunch of different choices of seafood trays. It's all shipped raw, but it's ready to cook. And you just put it in a frying pan for like 10, 15 minutes. And that's it.
Nice.
Super simple.
So they made all these innovations and that was well received, I guess. But
you know, it evolved over time. Like I remember my dad telling me at one point, and this is going back to the next, my dad passed away in 96. So I think this was probably like 95, I'm going to say. I remember having this conversation with him about how I want to take how we're doing these really popular fajitas and bring it out like a mobile truck or mobile stand. I was being like an entrepreneur. And he was looking at me because I just finished USC and I had a job in banking and then insurance, you know.
Yeah.
He's like, why in the hell do you want to do that? He goes, I've been busting my ass my whole life and just now do I feel like I don't have to worry about money too much.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? Like, I didn't know. Yeah. I had no idea, you know. And it's kind of stuck with me. Like, I don't know, maybe I am crazy, but this whole desk job thing isn't doing it for me. Like the cubicle desk job and the stress of what I was doing. I was like, I'd rather have the freedom. I had to kind of negotiate with him to come back to work.
You know, oh, really?
Well, because I had the choice too. It's like, you can come and work here or I'll pay for you to go to USC. What do you want to do? And I was like, well, okay.
And you chose USC.
So I went to SC. I transferred in.
He didn't pay for you to go to USC just to come back to the family business.
Yeah. So he was like, what the hell is going on? And I'm like, you don't understand. It sucks out there. Yeah. So
you had to go out to appreciate it enough to really want it.
But you know what happened too is like my dad passes away. It's like 1999. It was like 2 months after my first daughter was born. I had come back to work. So I had all this time to spend with him, like one-on-one that I wouldn't have had otherwise. Like I even go to the gym with him, you know, because he was always overweight and like all these heart issues, but he had like massive heart surgery and he was getting himself into shape. So we'd just go on the elliptical together, you know, like chat in the morning. Then I would see him at work later. And it was really cool. Like if I hadn't gone back to work there, I wouldn't have had a lot of time with him. So that was really good.
Yeah.
And when he, you know, sadly, like when he passed away, I was supposed to be at the gym. He actually died on the elliptical, had a heart attack working on the elliptical. I was supposed to be next to him that day, but my daughter was having her shots. I'm like, I can't go. Isn't that crazy?
Whoa.
So.
Oh my God.
It's like, I kind of looked back at all that. I was like, okay, maybe I need to go do something else. Like he didn't want me to be here. I'm glad I had this time with him. But I did go to school and I did have all these other jobs. So I had the idea to go and open my own restaurant. And so I went and I ran our little Wilmington location as a test because there was a restaurant there.
Mm-hmm.
And I expanded it and added like 500 seats and went through all the process and learned as much as I could about it. Actually, I didn't learn the marketing. That was probably the biggest pitfall. But I went and opened my own restaurant for a bit. It was a disaster. Like almost bankruptcy disaster. Like I thought I knew everything and I realized everything I didn't know. And part of it was I was alone. Like I realized the whole time my family was doing this, they all had one another to help. Even if they didn't agree and if they were fighting, they made it work. And I was like on this island completely alone.
Right.
And they weren't happy that I had left to do this. Right. I'm doing it. I want to do my own thing and try it out. So all that got washed out and it was fine. And I ended up going back to work for my family. But what happened when I came back to work was one of my dad's sisters was our financial controller. Right. And that was her background. She's the only one besides me that went to college and did something else. And she came back because she wanted to be home with the kids. And this gave her the ability to work, you know, 9 to 5 or 8 to 2. So she could drop them off at school, come do all her financials and go home. Well, she comes down with pancreatic cancer. Right. And they've given her like a couple weeks. And I've just had come back. Right. When this happens and she passes away, real sad. And my sister was like, I don't know what she was doing. Like, I don't understand how she was managing our finances. I didn't ever have to deal with any of that. I was just her assistant filing. So I'm like, so the family's like, you know, I know you want to leave and do something else, but can you at least, you're the only one to school. Maybe you can figure out what she was doing because we don't know what she was doing. We don't understand the banking and finance part of it.
Right.
And so it had this weird goosebump moment where I'm sitting there at her desk going, okay, well, this is an insurance thing. You know, we have to get, because I was a claim negotiator at State Farm Insurance. Like, we got to get a release and this and that, call our insurance guy. This is all I did there. And then there was a banking issue and I was in banking. So I'm like, well, we have to do this, this, and this to get the banking stuff done. And then we need accounting software, which I had set up at my restaurant before it failed. And I was like, if I hadn't left and had all those failures,
you wouldn't have been prepared for what you had to do.
I don't know who would have stepped in there. And it gave me the ability to look at the business as a whole and really see what our financial situation, what we were earning, what we were making, improve. And then that's kind of where it set me off from that point forward.
That's amazing. And then, so how did you get from there to becoming where you are today, CEO, running it with your family?
I didn't leave again, so I stayed. I think what was happening is we've always had plenty of people running the operations. Like inside the four walls was really never an issue. So I was really trying to figure out what could I do to be kind of exercise my creativity to something different. I created a line of packaged meals, which did okay for a little bit, but we just didn't have the background of the network to build that. So I created a line of frozen meals. We packaged our seasoning and hot sauces. We started doing some e-commerce. At one point, we were in 6,000 different grocery stores in maybe 5 or 6 states. But again, it's super competitive and the margins are really small. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really profitable because you need to have a team that understands how all that works, that can take and sell it for you and just cut you a commission, in my opinion. It's super competitive. And so I learned a lot about it. But what happened was, I created it in a way where we could trademark the intellectual property and tell our story on the printed bags. So 6,000 stores are selling our story and it's going into people's homes. And that was really powerful. The other thing that happened was we had some producers that were doing a show for YouTube. YouTube had started their own channel called The Hungry Channel, which was sort of like a competitor to the Food Network.
Okay.
It didn't last, but these guys filmed some stuff with us. We got along with them really well. And we used to do this annual lobster festival. And they said, we heard you're going to try to set 3 Guinness World Records in a single day. And we want to film it because you guys are really good on the camera. And we think there's the potential to create a TV show out of it. So they filmed us. They produced a sizzle reel. They shopped it to all the networks, but nobody wanted it. They loved it, you know, but they're like, it's too much like Duck Dynasty with fish. And it doesn't work for what we're looking for right now. But they gave me the sizzle reel to use. The guys, they were cool. And nice. I want to test this because I have a potential opportunity in Texas with a grocery store chain called HEB. They're not going to know us because that's Texas or California. So I brought it and I go, well, here's who we are. And I played the sizzle reel.
A Hollywood of you.
Yeah. They were so like taken by it. They're like, well, we're doing a whole bunch of stuff with the Duck Dynasty guys. They're flying in right now. I'm like, yeah, but there's no TV show. Is this just a marketing? Yeah, but what channels are going to be on? They couldn't get around the fact that there was nothing to back it up. So they placed this huge order. I go, I don't have any other episodes. It's not on TV. I can't really back up the marketing. But they overbought based on their misperception of what I was showing them. And I couldn't reel it back in.
Oh my God.
So it didn't sell. You know? I mean, it sold okay, but it wasn't enough to be a hit for them.
Yeah.
And I realized like this whole TV show thing's got something we're missing.
Yeah.
So we decided to try to produce it on our own. So a combination of understanding content creation and media and then getting involved with our social media channels and really like owning that and controlling our story, it created a double-digit growth in our company and our gross annual sales for like 10 straight years, which was unprecedented for us. So we were kind of floating around, you know, like this $10 million sale mark for on and off for a long time. And you'd get below, get below, get above. And then all of a sudden we started climbing up to where we got to 30. in a matter of like 10 years.
And you credit social media for that.
It was all the stuff that I was working on in the background. I started to look at it and track like these jumps. What did we do this year that caused this jump? Oh, yeah. We launched this product. Oh, we were on this TV show. Oh, we put this out. Well, at one point we were in the top 10 most Instagram restaurants, like 3 years in a row on Instagram. Because that wasn't us. That was just customers.
Right.
But all that, you could see all these jumps correlated with these different actions. Then if we were just head down, butt up cutting fish, we wouldn't have known to look for or understood.
What's the best social media platform, in your opinion, that helped the business really grow?
For us, the biggest one for a long time was Facebook. Now I think Instagram is probably going to beat it. We're just starting to look at TikTok. I think TikTok is probably on... I don't think we're using it enough.
TikTok. You guys have a TikTok?
Yeah.
Yeah. TikTok is, that's a big one.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of conversations with people that are doing content creation and they're saying restaurants are exploding faster off TikTok than any other platform.
Really? Yeah. Wow.
But they're all different, you know, and I'm not an expert. So you got to bring in experts to tell you.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, like we've never had luck with YouTube. And I'm realizing like YouTube is huge if you can, you know, crack the code, so to speak. Like somebody sent me Mr. Beast's like internal document that got leaked somehow of how they've built their empire, you know, on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I was like, everybody sent this to me.
But didn't Mr. Beast pages. Just kind of start putting videos out when he was like 10 or 13 years old or something like that?
He's young. And if you listen to what they did, it's like, that's all they did. They just researched and studied.
I saw him talk about this. Have you ever seen him talk? Mm-hmm. Like he's so funny because he strikes me as kind of very, almost like introverted. Yeah. Personality, right? Yeah. But like he's this huge sensation. And he was saying like he just recorded himself playing a video game or something like that. And it got 20,000 hits. And he was like, that was it. He was addicted to it at that moment. And that's all he wanted was to put content onto YouTube.
It's a hell of a dopamine hit right there. 20,000 hits playing a video game.
I know. I mean, I couldn't imagine, especially if you're like a young kid.
Yeah.
You know?
And now there's so much content, right? Like I had read yesterday, I think there's 3 million different podcasts. But the thing I'm interested in, like people are doing really well with them, right? It's not like, despite the fact that there's so many and what I've been learning is I think it really comes down to the power of telling your story.
Yeah.
I think storytelling is really, like the stuff that you do or you don't reveal till the end. I forget the name of it.
The way they did it?
Yeah. Like I love those because it sucks you in. And then at the end, you're like, oh, that's who that was.
Yeah.
You know, I got to listen to it again now. Yeah. And that's great. One of the guys that I'm working with is a guy named Sean Walshef out of San Diego. And he turned his restaurant into a media company. He produces multiple shows. And his thing was like, be the show, not the commercial. It's like a sketch phrase. And I was talking to him about it. He goes, you know, my kids learned how to fast forward past commercials when they're like 2. You know, nobody wants to see a commercial.
Right.
So if you're doing commercials to promote yourself, people are just going to fast forward them. Just be the show and tell your story and be authentic. And
right.
He didn't know we had the Kings of Fish at the time. And I go, watch this.
Yeah.
And he goes, yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. I wasn't thinking about it the way he was. But that's our, you know, our TV show, which, sorry, I jumped ahead on that. But that's, you know, streaming on Amazon now. And ultimately what happened is we decided to just produce our own series. We called the Kings of Fish. We did it originally on Facebook, which is why, because that was really where our followership was at the time. And there were 5-minute episodes and there were 4-story arcs. And we did like 7 of them. The last one was all during COVID. We just like, we should capture this. No one's capturing this. And I don't think, I haven't really looked back at them, but the people that kids go, man, you know, I'm in the restaurant industry and I tried to erase all that from my memory. I forgot what we went through. And you captured all of it in like a television quality arc of stories. I'm like, yeah, I don't want to look at it either.
It's crazy to think back about what we all dealt with. And I feel very fortunate to have been in a role where it was like, you know, turns out we didn't have to go into the office and everything was fine. Your screen pops up, but the computer is in like Weehawken in New Jersey.
Yeah.
The home computer. And you're just getting a visual of it, right? When you log in. And so you could really log in anywhere. So it turned out that it was like everything was fine. There were no hiccups on our end, but I can't even imagine what it was like for people like you in the restaurant business.
Yeah. We were lucky because we had plenty of challenges. Don't get me wrong. Like we opened a new location in Long Beach 6 weeks before COVID, you know, and it was took 4 years Good to timing. Open, I think, you know, or whatever it was. Like, I think I signed the lease in 2017 and we opened in 2020 because there was just so many problems with the building and we couldn't get financing. And then there was a lawsuit inside the family. It was just like one thing after the other. And we finally opened it. Yay. And everything got shut down.
Oh.
And we had to figure out how to make that work. We just kept innovating and trying new stuff because that's just how we are. San Pedro is lucky because the San Pedro, the main legacy locations, which actually eventually evolved into two locations. The developers that built around us built a copycat restaurant called Krusty Krab, which was literally next door. So eventually we just acquired it. Mm-hmm. And then that added our footprint. So we went from, 300 seats, and eventually we built the deck out farther and farther. And then we connected seatings with
someone just Krab. Opened next to you and tried to copy you.
Our landlord. Yeah.
Your landlord.
Well, I shouldn't say that. The landlord was always the Port of Los Angeles, but it was supposed to be this development of the Portsmouth Village. And what was happening is the developer wanted, he was going to open a seafood restaurant fish market. And he wanted us to run it, but we decided to just do our own. So he opened it anyways and had somebody else running it, which eventually just became us. What happened is we became so popular that we needed other businesses to handle our spillover.
The overflow.
So we just ended up taking it over.
Yeah.
So ultimately we ended up with 3,000 seats on 55,000 square feet because the two restaurants had grown to basically combine each other because they're next door. So that made us one of the largest restaurants in the country.
So I've got a question for you because we specialize in wealth management and financial planning a lot. We work a lot with business owners and a lot of family held businesses. And so I was going to ask you to maybe talk a little bit about some of the benefits and challenges of managing a family business. There must be unique challenges when everyone else that's running the company is your family.
Yeah, there's a ton. Sometimes what happens in a family business is you're doing things to keep family happy that isn't always in the best interest of the business. And that can stifle growth. What I found worked for us is I didn't want to get into the operational part of it any more than I needed to because everybody was an operator. One of the biggest problems we had was people just weren't on the same page because when you're focusing on head down, butt up labor, you're not standing up to like cheer the crowd on and create these narratives that unite everybody and say, this is like a lot of restaurants you'll work in. They'll have like a shift meeting. They're telling everybody, this is, we're going to do this and you're going to handle this and go, come on guys, let's go. And there's a hand clap or a high five or whatever. And you're like building the team up. Ours was always like, what the hell, where you been? Get to work. And you'd have these situations where one person in particular shares a story, which I've seen a gazillion times, which was your brother came in and told me to do this thing this way. But then your uncle, who's essentially my dad, because Tommy and his mom had been together forever, so basically married, right? Tommy comes and tells me to do it one way. Your brother tells me to do it another way. Your other brother told me to do it a different way, all within the same 10 minutes. So I chose Tommy because I'm going to be having dinner with him tonight. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're not going with what's best for the business anymore. You're just trying to keep things peaceful. Right. And so that was an ongoing thing in our business for decades. So what I worked to change was bringing in outside help. There was a couple of different coaches I brought in that I don't like this guy. It makes me feel uncomfortable. Well, coaching will do that.
Yes, it will.
But I get it and I'm not pushing. And we ultimately settled on two systems that have really massively shifted the culture. But why the opening for that to take place was COVID, because when you think you're going to go out of business and there's nobody coming in and you don't have to do it, you're very open to ideas.
Yeah.
Right. But you also get this Lord of the Fly thing that happens that I didn't think about till recently, which is once there's a certain level of comfort, somebody always asserts themselves and wants to take over again, whether they even realize they're doing it or not. And so we were able to institute some cultural shift during COVID using the Entrepreneur Operating System, which was a big one. But also I have a friend named Ron that created a coaching system called the Macklin Connection. And between the two, they really complement each other. And Ron's stuff was very new, but I was involved with him when he was developing it. And it was really about creating self-led teams and accountability. And the idea was like, it's really comfortable to just be told what to do. And the average person would prefer that. But in order to be competitive and change and expand and open these new locations, you need people that are going to be able to have the tools that they need to do the best job they can do and just have you believing in them and supporting them. Listen, this is our goals as a company, which we set in the Entrepreneur Operating System, EOS. Here's our rocks. Here's our goals. Here's what we're after. Mm-hmm. Here's the seats that the company needs in order to make that work. And so we're not going to design a seat for you, Angaro family member or a Mafutano family member. We're going to create seats the company needs. You need someone to handle finance. Someone has to do HR. Someone needs to do marketing. Someone needs to do operations. And we're going to define what those seats are. And then we're going to see, do you get it? Do you want it? Do you have the capacity? Because if you don't, we're going to find somebody else. And you have to be aligned with the core values of the company. That's totally, all that stuff is totally foreign in a family-owned business.
Yeah, it does, because you have to prioritize the business over the family.
Yeah, because without the business, the family can't eat.
Yes.
So let me go back to what we work with on the Macklin side, which was people are ultimately fundamentally scared. I don't want to look like an idiot. I'm not feeling valued. No one's listening to me. if you would just listen to me, I could be happy. And the thing is like, okay, well, we might be listening, but what you want to do isn't necessarily it's in the best interest of the business. Well, now you're telling me I'm stupid and I don't know what I'm doing. So now I'm just going to prove you wrong by showing you that I knew what I was talking about. And then, you know, it's like, it becomes toxic.
Yeah.
So it was more or less like, hey, we're open to anything you want to do, but if it doesn't work, you have to own it. And if you're comfortable with that, we'll support you. And by the way, if it fails, we'll come in and we'll help you out. And so that's been a very slow shift. I'd say 90% of the people that have been with us a long time are starting to see it. If you go to episode 6 of our web series, we actually talk about it. There's a whole scene where they're completing the 18-week Macklin workshop and sharing stories about how it changed the way their lives are. I mean, ultimately, it was about being in the same boat and rowing in the same direction. Because we might have been in the same boat, but we weren't rowing in the same direction. And then we started working EOS, and everybody understood what their goals were and where they were supposed to go. They were competing with one another.
Right.
And what we're trying to do is, no, we're in the same boat, and we need to row in the same direction, and we all need to be on the same team helping one another out to achieve these goals that we'll all benefit from. It's a long version of what you're saying, but it wasn't there before. It was really just everybody waiting to be told what to do in the family business and not get yelled at.
Yeah.
And then get sneaky. Like Tommy would leave every Sunday about 5 o'clock. And you could hear it on all the radios that the security guards and the managers had. Code 9, Tommy's gone. You could hear the unpuckering. Everybody suddenly just relaxed.
Okay. Right.
And
right.
There's still a ton of customers. There's thousands of people there. It's not like there wasn't anything to do.
Right.
But everybody could just kind of get in the rhythm relax, have a taco, whatever food we had on the side for the employees, pizza, and wait till the day ended.
Yeah. Because you guys work together. And you guys are all family. And so you at the end of the day, like, are you guys kind of just treat each other as coworkers and you don't want to see each other outside of work? Or like, are you guys?
No, I mean,
like still get together.
We still get together, holidays, birthdays and everything. Like Thanksgiving will be the next one. We'll see everybody. But, you know, it's fine. Everybody comes over.
Yeah.
Everybody gets along. The wives will get along. The Moff-Tano stuff and then Garo stuff's always been separate. Because it's always like, we're going to do our holiday this day and you're going to work. Like Tommy would always work on Thanksgiving and we'd take it off. And then he'd do Thanksgiving on Monday and we would work Monday. So to get the two big ownership families together is pretty rare because of the way that we danced around that.
I see.
But on my side, it's like I've got two brothers and a sister. Everybody's married and everybody's got kids. So when you get the whole family together, it's 20, 30 people. And the cousins love each other. They hang out. Some of them work in the business. Some of them don't. You know, there's always a birthday, an anniversary, graduation. It's like wedding, funeral, whatever. There's always something going on while we're seeing one another.
So. Right. Your grandfather founded the business. Mm-hmm. Your father grew it substantially. Mm-hmm. And what do you want your legacy to be?
I would like my legacy to be that this business took care of the next two generations based on what I set in place at whatever point my exit looks like. Whether it's owning it and operating it, or that it can operate under a different team and they can just be a board of directors and still benefit from it. But I want it to be able to create like opportunities. Like I really try hard not to think of us as a restaurant or a fish market, but more of a brand. You know, like we're creating content, we're doing e-commerce. I think that we're becoming more of a media brand. And I think that's kind of inevitable. I think you have to do that.
You went from restaurant to brand.
Yeah, that's great. That's what it is.
Yeah. You know, there's this stat that is often cited that 30% of family businesses make it to the second generation and 10 to 15 make it to the third and 3 to 5 make it to the fourth. And there's a lot of people who dispute that because that was... I don't know if you know the background on this.
No, but I just assumed it was true.
Yeah, because everybody says it. And I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just based on this one study that was done in like 1980 out of Illinois, and it was done on manufacturing jobs. And it was manufacturing companies. And that's kind of where all of it came from. Despite a lot of people disputing that, there's like a lot of old world wisdom that backs that up. There's that Scottish proverb, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. And there's a Brazilian saying, rich father, noble son, poor grandson. And so there's a lot of old world wisdom there, too, that kind of suggests that over time, these things are really hard to keep together. Do you ever think about that?
That's been my primary focus in everything I said, bringing in all the help, because my biggest concern was we weren't going to make it to the next generation, because you could see the difference. You know, the way my simple version of that is the first generation was raised a certain way, and then we married different people and the kids get raised a different way. Not good or bad. It's just different. You know, they're not like being forced into the business and like told what to do. And you would see some family members, and this changes over time, by the way, but it was like certain family members on my side would come in and go, you know, I'm an owner here. Like it was already in their head. They're going to be an owner when they were like 10. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you got to earn that, dude.
Yeah.
And so that's shifted too. And it really just comes down to the parenting. The way I look at the way we've raised our daughters is to raise adults, not children. And I think that served them well. Like, they're pretty independent. The two of them have worked in the business and got a lot of life lessons. And then they've moved on, and one of them moved on to, you know, that creative artist agency doing something totally different. But it's a harsh business to be in entertainment. And what she learned working in our restaurant during COVID and dealing with people, it's like taught her a lot of that. So it is a big concern of mine. And so what we have done was created, you know, we've rebuilt the business structures so that if we as owners decided, well, you're an owner, but you're a class B shareholder. In other words, like, you're going to own the business, you'll benefit from it, but you're going to have to meet certain criteria in order to be a decision maker. So that means show up, work hard, go to school, learn something. Here's all the different things we do. There's like 23 different things I'm dealing with in business all the time. Mm-hmm. Which one do you want to help me with?
Right.
And then the really hard part is if a family member doesn't show up or doesn't, you know, if they stop coming in, it's like, it becomes an HR issue, you know, because one of our core values is family. And so we try to look at all of the employees as family members, not just based on their last name. And yeah. if you don't honor yeah. that core value falls apart.
Right.
And so that's a what I'm trying to get to is we have to lead by example. So if our kids don't show up, we got to be willing to fire them. And I don't have a problem doing that, but looking at the rest of the family, you got to be okay with it too.
Absolutely.
And they have to deal with that consequence.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. What do you think of this trend that we're seeing of automation in the restaurant business? You've probably seen what Chipotle is doing and Sweetgreen is doing, yeah. Yeah, Flippy and all that.
Yeah. Chippy and Flippy.
What do you think about all that? You can have a robot fish descaler soon.
Yeah, it's creepy on one hand.
It is.
Yeah, but there's an entire restaurant right in, I think, Pasadena. That's a hamburger place. Is that right? That's completely automated. There's like no
the whole
people
thing?
In it. Yeah.
Oh.
I think they deliver the food and then you just go to the window and that burger pops out. If I read it correctly.
I can't come to terms with it.
Different versions of it, right? There's the ones you're talking about where there's actually robots doing all the work. There's other ones where it's all cameras and automation that analyze how people work together. You know, like, it'll look at a pizza place and it'll say, you know, when Bob is working with Jane, they seem to just be screwing around a lot. But when Jim is working with John, they're really efficient and they're on it. And it analyzes this and it creates things where you can actually schedule people to be more efficient. It'll also analyze the amount of cheese that's going on a pizza and the time it's going in. So there's ways that it's creating more efficiency in human teams. I've seen that. I think it's going to be inevitable because unless there's some change to minimum wage, like, the cost of employees is really high. And people are like, I really want to get paid more, but I don't want to have to pay more for goods and services. But they're tied together.
Yeah, they are.
So you're getting to the point where you get priced out. And so what'll happen is you'll have to automate. Like, one of the ways that we've automated is with machines. So we didn't get into this part of the story, but, you know, we had to leave our legacy location, right? Our 55,000 square feet. March 3rd, we got evicted. We had to leave that business. And so we had to figure out, well, we got 400 employees. What are we going to do? Our enterprise was really based on the success of these locations. So we pivoted and moved over to a parking lot that's like 20 or 30,000 square feet, and we reopened in 60 days. How do you reopen in 60 days? We can't get a fish market. It's outside in the parking lot. There's no plumbing. There's no electrical. There's no utilities. There's no bathrooms. There's nothing. So we had to make this like a festival area where everything's portable. But we're trying to figure out, how are people going to place an order and be served? You don't have a counter to walk up to the same way you did before because you have these portable kitchens and trailers. My nephew, Henry Jr., does our IT, instituted a program called Me and You and put in a new point of sale system called Toast. These two things work together. So here you have basically new kind of automation. Mm-hmm. And what it is, it's a QR code system. Most, if you've ever been to a restaurant where you scan the QR code, right? Really common during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been to a restaurant with 1,000 seats outside? Yeah,
no.
Right. So none of those QR systems were designed really to have that many seats, which is why we never instituted them. But Me and You did have that technology and they could work with Toast. So now you have a system where you don't need servers to go and take orders. You can scan the QR code, the kitchen gets the order, knows where you're sitting, and a runner sends it out. So that's a form of lowering your labor costs,
mm-hmm.
creating more efficiencies. And so with that, and it was a test, but we didn't have a choice. It was the only way we could reopen in 60 days. But it demonstrated that you could use technology to lower labor costs and still get the customer the food. So in the past, the way San Pedro Fish prior to eviction worked, customers drove about 100 miles or more. There's no parking. So they're parking off site. They're walking about a mile, strollers, wheelchairs, walkers, to get in line to get into the business, which could be another hour. Then once they got in, you had to stand in this line for fish, this line for beer, this line for crab, this line. So smart people that have been there multiple times, they like strategic, right? You go get in those lines, I'll go get a table.
Yeah, right.
And that was all the work was on the customer to do that. And so you had a commitment of 3 hours maybe before you ate from the time you left your house. And a lot of people were driving from Phoenix and from Las Vegas. That's a 5 hour drive. And they go home the same day.
No way. People were coming out.
They're tracking this.
From Vegas or Phoenix just to come and eat at San Pedro Fish Market.
Bay Area. Yeah. And they're going back home the same day. We had become like an iconic attraction where people, but they're coming with three or four generations of their family to do this. So when we went to this parking lot situation, we don't know if people are still going to come or not, because there's no way to effectively communicate with that many people. There isn't.
Yeah.
So now they're coming in and they're like, crap, you're in a parking lot? Well, we're right by the water still. So they're still dealing with the parking situation and the line. But once they got in the facility, they didn't have to go get in six different lines. That last hour went away because they could just sit down, QR code a shrimp tray and a beer. I'm waiting for my shrimp tray, another beer, another beer, another beer. At one point, we were selling more Modelo.
Did your beer sales go up a lot?
Yes. So we were selling more Modelo than Angel Stadium before this. And what we found out was people were like, I would have ordered a lot more beer if I didn't have to wait in that long line because you only had two places for me to buy it or three places, whatever. Well, now they're just sitting down scanning beers and we're just running it to them. So we're like, oh my God, we created this incredible efficiency using technology, which in a way is sort of like an AI, I guess you could say. I mean, it's not exactly, but it does automate a lot of the labor that way. The runners are making sometimes $200-$400 in tips.
Wow.
Because Toast has that 18-20% thing that you click off automatically.
Yeah, you just click it. Yeah.
Well, so here you have, like I have my nephews telling my brother, Dad, I need gas money. Can I come to work today? I'll just run food to the tables. That's easily $200-$300 in tips. Like, what the heck? It's like ridiculous.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
So it actually benefited everybody. The customer gets their product faster and the employees were making more money.
What's the best thing your mother or father ever taught you?
No one's ever asked me that question before. I probably had a cook, I would say. Spring break, you ever go to Palm Springs?
Oh, yeah. Love Palm Springs. So we go every year.
We used to go to Palm Springs when I was in high school for spring break and college. And I was like, I'm going to make cioppino. I've never made it before. It seems simple. I asked my mom for the recipe, like, how do you do it? Yeah, I never had. So I went to the fish market to grab all this seafood, lobster, crab, swordfish, right? And you just make like all day at the hotel room. We'd get a hotel room with a kitchen, like a kitchen suite.
Yeah.
Or we'd rent a house later on. And you just simmer the tomato sauce and the onions and garlic all day long and then throw on the fish at the end and then make a ton of garlic bread with rice. Then you could drink all night then because it's all the rice and bread.
Right. That's awesome. But what are you working on now?
Oh, man. What am I working on? I have a couple projects I'm working on. One is our Kings of Fish. We're working to get season 2 and 3. Being on Amazon Prime was like a huge accomplishment, right? So we were doing all these 5-minute episodes and someone reached out to us and say, you know, you moved from Coke to Pepsi. Pepsi's offering some money because everyone's home during COVID and they need content. So we repackaged it and reshot it into what it is now, 8 20-minute episodes and we got it on Amazon Prime. Huge accomplishment. I'm still not 100% sure how it happened. Mm-hmm. It's like I go back on all this twists and turns on the way there, but it's a huge accomplishment. We want to build on that. So that would be my biggest project is getting the next two seasons and actually turning it into more of a profit stream because we finance a lot of it. And the whole thing with Pepsi has always been kind of wonky. Like, are they paying us or not paying us? Who was it them? Was it an agency? We never got anything concrete, but the eviction storyline was a great place to reshoot and show people this is what we're doing. So they know we're still open. So multiple seasons of that and really working with our business partners to make them part of the project. Like, hey, you know, why just Pepsi? We're selling all this Modelo that's like featuring Modelo or, you know, we're talking to our tech stack, all the different tech companies that we use for, like I mentioned earlier, Toast, me and you, there's Paycom's our new payroll company. We're bringing all them in. There's opportunities to be featured in the show because we're shortly, it's probably in the news by now, but we're actually going to be opening a new location in Monterey on Fisherman's Wharf. We secured like a 17,000 square foot location there. That's a big deal for us. It's 6-7 hours away. If it works out the way it's supposed to work out, which it will, we're going to rebrand ourselves and take all the things that were really popular in our legacy location. We hired a company called Studios that does Eataly's, like the one that's right over here by your office. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're helping us to redesign how to be an experiential brand and not just a seafood restaurant. So Monterey is basically the first version of that. And then we're going to rebuild San Pedro on a 60,000 square foot pad. It's going to be probably 3,000 to 4,000 seats. That will be our biggest project. It'll be experiential. You know, it'll be stations like we had before. You can go here and get this, go here and go that. And like really something that you can spend some time in and enjoy and tell your families about.
I know we talked about it, but how can people find you?
If you go to our website, sanpedrofish.com, or any of our social media handles, which are all at San Pedro Fish, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, also kingsoffishtv.com. That's the landing page for our TV show. And if you have Amazon Prime and search Kings of Fish, you'll see the show.
Yeah, it's awesome. I'm enjoying it. I enjoyed having this fishy conversation with you.
So. Let me know when I can send you some.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I'll come over and cook it with you.
Yeah, my son would appreciate that.
Christmas is coming.
It is. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate you coming on.
All right, thanks. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michael Ungaro. The story of San Pedro Fish Market is a strong example of the power of legacy. What legacy do you want to leave behind? Reach out to me at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com and let's discuss it. Now, here's a short success story about someone you might know. A delinquent youth, mathematical genius, and creator of one of history's most reviled inventions, Andy Hildebrand was no ordinary man. Born in Coronado, California in 1954, Andy's intelligence was indisputable. His ability to sit in a classroom, however, was sorely lacking. After failing first grade, his teachers simply moved him to the back of the classroom to gaze out the window after they tired of smacking his hands with a ruler. Things changed when he discovered his passion for science, earning his first B in junior high and even scraping together A's by his senior year. Driven by this newfound love, he pursued a PhD in electrical engineering, immersing himself in the world of numbers and signals. After graduation, Andy landed a job with a major oil company, Exxon. His task was complex, using seismic data to help pinpoint drilling locations. His expertise came to the forefront when Exxon faced a crisis with their Alaskan pipeline project. With time running out, Andy applied his mathematical skills to solve the problem, saving the company a staggering sum of money. This success propelled him to leave Exxon and start his own venture in geophysics, creating a company that would revolutionize the industry. Years passed, and after a successful exit from his company, Andy returned to his musical roots, studying composition and creating digital audio tools that transformed how music was produced. One of his innovations, and his greatest legacy, was nothing short of a mathematical miracle. The project was so complex, it required an almost savant application of signal processing and statistics that many believed was not possible without a supercomputer. Drawing on the work he had done as an oil engineer, he developed an advanced equation to simplify the math. This new technology was used in secret by the music industry for years, as it provided automatic pitch corrections, which allowed singers to record perfect takes every time. His invention had a coming-out party when Cher's producers decided to intentionally misuse this tool, making the singer's voice sound robotic. Love it or hate it, Cher's Believe hit shelves in October 1998, selling 11 million copies worldwide, earning her a Grammy Award and topping the charts in 23 countries. And the use of Andy's technology, Auto-Tune, changed music forever. And that's the way he did it.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.